Could you briefly introduce yourself?
So my name is Sarah Walker, and I'm an assistant professor here at Colorado State University. I'm in the Human Dimensions of Natural Resources, which is essentially a group of social scientists that work on environmental issues of natural resources, a lot of conservation work. I'm relatively new to my role here. I just started in January, but I'm not new to CSU, as I did my PhD here and graduated back in 2021.
Okay, great. So I read that much of your research is focused on equitable climate adaptation, rural livelihoods, and change in environments, as well as the health and well-being effects of nature immersion. Can you tell me a little bit more about your research, as well as what questions and puzzles that you're trying to solve and answer?
Yeah, this is always an important question that every researcher is supposed to be able to answer, but always more difficult than you think it's going to be. The way I sort of explain the stuff that I work on is I think about human well-being as a tool to better understand people's relationships with their environment. That's like the broad overarching. Human well-being is this like really important component. If we can understand it in culturally specific, gender specific, social identity specific ways, we can use it to understand people's behavior in their interactions with the environment. And then we can also use it to design environmental solutions that benefit people, that are both equitable and effective. And so I sort of see this well-being and equity as these are two very interlinked concepts, that well-being and understanding it in a nuanced way helps us be able to do equitable environmental work. And so right now, I sort of have two areas that fall under that broad category. One of them is focused on thinking about changing environments and specifically climate adaptation. So can we use well-being as a way to sort of measure and design adaptation strategies? Most of my work in East Africa has been around this concept of climate adaptation and doing it equitably using this well-being framework. And so thinking specifically about how do we ensure that our resilience interventions or our drought adaptation interventions, particularly in northern Kenya, take into account and consider well-being impacts on women in pastoral communities. And so that's been a lot of sort of that type of work. I've also sort of grown my research program to include thinking about equitable adaptation here in the U.S., particularly in working with the Nature Conservancy in upstate New York and looking at flooding adaptation strategies and how that impacts rural communities with an equity lens to it. I've been doing a little bit of work on fire here in Colorado. And so we sort of have that frame or group of work that's in this well-being, equitable adaptation space. And then I also am thinking about sort of the other side of the nature well-being relationship, which is that we know that nature does a lot of good things for us when we spend time outside. And so thinking about the well-being benefits that outdoor recreation and nature access can provide folks for their own health and well-being, particularly as a way to build people's environmental ethic. So those are sort of the two areas that I'm working on right now, but all couched under this idea that well-being can help us understand people's interactions with their environment.
So are you trying to keep the work, since there are two areas, are you trying to marry them together or try to looking at them separately? How are you trying to...
Yeah, so I think there's some stuff that feels very separate. And then there's some of my work, especially so that this newer stuff that we're writing grant proposals for and doing some study design on that is very much at the intersection of this work. Mm-hmm. One of the ways we're doing that right now is thinking about the role that there's all of these programs that are all excited about the health and well-being benefits that people get from spending outside, and that we can improve community well-being through some of these outdoor recreation programs. We also know that when people spend more time outside, they're probably more likely to engage in pro-environmental behaviors or sort of environmental ethic. There's a relationship there. There might be this, like, there's other variable that's like your sense of connection or your ecological identity, how strongly you feel connected to the natural world.
Right.
My question is can we use all of these really cool programs and interventions as sort of a vehicle for thinking about climate adaptation and climate literacy? And so if we get people more outside, get them outside more, and we get them recognizing these benefits, and we simultaneously get them to acknowledge the way that climate change or sort of a non-resilient landscape sort of might decrease some of those benefits, can we use that as sort of a leverage point for climate adaptation? So that's sort of one example of what that work looks like at the intersection.
Yeah.
But the stuff, you know, my work mostly focused in East Africa right now. And when you asked about like questions and puzzles that you're interested in, you know, my dissertation work, as most people's dissertation work does, leaves you with more questions than answers. And something that came out in both my data and just in conversations with friends and community members there is sort of the role and relationship that adaptation behaviors are having with gender roles. In a community where, at least in Samburu, gender roles feel incredibly malleable and dynamic, particularly right now, in that what it means to be a woman and what it means to what your roles and responsibilities traditionally are seems to be changing. And a lot of folks that I talked to and some of my preliminary data points to that relationship of changing landscapes and changing gender roles. And I'm really curious about the relationship between those two things. And so to be like a specific example is when we think about shifting to small-scale livestock as a drought adaptation strategy in a place like Kenya. We know that that's shifting the responsibility of livestock to women. And so there's a narrative, at least in the academic world, that this is increasing sort of labor responsibilities and stress and workload. And so there's this negative implication of climate adaptation. I also think there's something about shifting sort of decision-making power on a landscape, both like what happens on the landscape and also what happens financially with small-scale livestock. And so I'm really curious about this. Like, I don't think this linear, oversimplistic narrative of adaptation equals women are working more captures the whole story. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of work happening around the world on this, but this is sort of the next area of this sort of women's agency and its relationship with climate adaptation, and how can we sort of pull the levers to increase adaptation or sort of support growth and agency, mm-hmm. and maybe not even growth and agency, but acknowledging inherent agency that's already in many of these communities for women, and not sort of oversimplifying this narrative that women are just a victim of climate adaptation. And so that's sort of the piece that we're interested in right now, and doing some collaborative community-based work on sort of women's experiences of their own changing gender roles over their lifespan and how that maps on to the changing landscape over their lifespan. That's sort of an exploratory project that we're working on right now. It's a ton of fun. It's very fascinating and very interesting. Where that's headed, I'm not sure yet, but this is sort of this question that I'm chasing right now, of this trying to better understand the flexibility and malleability of gender roles and women's agency and climate change at the same time.
So speaking of East Africa, you recently traveled to Kenya over the mm-hmm. summer for your research. Can you just tell me a little bit more about the trip? What were some of the findings and experiences that you had over the summer?
Yeah, so the first reason, or the main reason that I went, is I was co-instructing a study abroad trip. So we had 10 students from our college here in Warner College taking a social ecological methods course, which we facilitate in Kenya. So the idea is, can we expose you to all of these different methods and simultaneously expose you to the very real and potentially negative consequences of cross-cultural research when done wrong, and the ethical implications of that, and then have students have a chance to sort of get a hands-on experience running sort of small studies and talking to community members about what community-based research should look like. Like, what does it mean when you go into a community and find out whether research is meeting needs of a local community? Can you even do that as a sort of an expat or somebody from a Western community coming into a place like Northern Kenya? And so that we're getting to sort of have students reflect on those questions and simultaneously get their methods experience at the same time. So we were doing that trip, and then I stayed for a couple weeks to mostly be thinking about, you know, I just recently finished my dissertation and wrap up a lot of that work, and sort of trying to figure out what next steps are, both with community organizations and partners, and then I have a group of community leaders and women in Samburu that I consider like my research advisory group. And so meeting with a lot of friends and colleagues up there to think about what does the next step look like? What is the natural next step that just doesn't meet my intellectual curiosity, but actually meets the needs of organizations and community leaders? And so that's sort of what we were talking through, doing some more dissemination of the dissertation results, hosting community workshops and going back to communities. And so much of, at least, you know, I'm never sure on how to meet the ethical needs of my work. Like, that is not something that I ever consider check the box and done. It is something that keeps me up at night. It's something I'm constantly thinking about. One thing that I know to be true is that the only way to do it is through really strong relationships. And those relationships take time and resources and maintenance. And so this last trip that I was on was less about collecting data and more about maintaining relationships and seeing friends and people that I consider family and who are also research colleagues, and sort of regrouping both my personal and professional relationships before figuring out what's next. So probably not a traditional answer to like, what were your findings of the trip? But the trip for me was about sort of resetting relationships and research agenda. And I think we did some of that. You can't do community work jumping in once every couple of years. I had lived there for a year in 2019 and for a couple of years prior to that. I moved back in December of 2019 and then COVID hit. And so I had not been back in just under 2 years. And so I knew I couldn't just jump back into community and start doing research when I hadn't been there for 2 years. So that was sort of I brought students, and then was also, I spent a couple of weeks just spending time with people.
Sounds good, yeah. So I'm a little bit curious, like looking at your work, you've worked at CSU, of course East Africa, and you mentioned mm-hmm. working in rural New York and mm-hmm. I think Canada as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me what these different experiences have been like in terms of like similarities, differences, working with the different cultures? How are you mm-hmm. just able to, I guess, assimilate mm-hmm. work with the different cultures?
Yeah, I think, you know, I grew up in a really rural agricultural based community in Ontario and Canada. And so I think my draw to rural communities is always my upbringing, growing up in sort of a farming community and a farming family. And sort of the recognition of the fundamental role that the landscape and the environment plays in your well-being, in your sort of identity, in sort of all different aspects of your life, and the way you know your parents and your grandparents and your neighbors. And so rural communities have always been a place I find myself drawn to and places that I can relate to. That being said, it's very easy to sort of overgeneralize my own experience with a place as different as Northern Kenya. And the first time I went to Simburu, I really didn't have an intention of working there. I knew I was interested in this concept of well-being. My undergrad degree is in positive psychology. And I, previous to coming into this space, I wanted to be a clinical psychologist. And I worked a couple years as a crisis counselor. And realized after a little bit of time that I was on the wrong end. I felt like reactive to people's sort of needs and struggles and challenges. And so got very obsessed with this. Instead of thinking about what's wrong with people, let's think about what's right with people, which is where the concept of well-being comes from, like what helps us flourish. And so I knew I wanted to study that, and I knew it was related to the environment. And then my advisor at the time told me, if you want to still study well-being, I think you better start thinking about it in a way that is more broad or than sort of your very own personal experience and in your very own culture. So like, let's go learn and think about what well-being means from a different perspective that is completely new to you. And so I went over and did my master's thesis on like a conservation and development sort of work in Kenya. I was only there for 4 or 5 months. And sort of similarly to my PhD, like just had more questions than I had answers and fell in love with the culture and the landscape. And I was really lucky to work with an advisor that had a lot of really strong relationships in the community. So it felt maybe there were some bridges to do that instead of jumping into a place where you don't know anybody and you don't have any relationships and sort of that sort of approach. But I would never pretend that I have Samburu culture totally figured out. Of course I don't. And first of all, culture is malleable. And so every time I go and every time I spend time there, I'm learning something new. But I think that is why I think it's so important that you're collaborating on research with folks who are a part of that culture and understand those pieces to it. And so I often find myself just like facilitating conversations with my team and coming from a place of being really humble about my lack of knowledge and information. And there are absolutely commonalities across rural communities, and there are also massive differences. And so learning to sort of navigate them and when to make that connection of this feels similar versus like, wait, hold yourself, think about this more critically and with more curiosity, I think is a really important strategy. Those of us that have gotten into research is because we're inherently curious people. Like, you wouldn't get into a graduate degree if you weren't. And so that is sort of the place I try to come at any entrance into community, whether that's Simburu or whether it's a small town in upstate New York.
So is there any, apart from like the curiosity and figuring out what's right with people and well-being, is there anything else that led you to the field that you're in now and this career path?
Well, I think I was telling you about the sort of my path, my sort of odd path of working in sort of the mental health space, deciding that's not what I wanted to do.
Yes.
And deciding I wasn't going to go into clinical psychology and moving back home. Mm-hmm. And ending up working for a local nonprofit that worked with sort of supporting youth and thinking about youth leadership and youth well-being and making sure that the most underserved parts of our community had access to sort of the resources and the education opportunities and things like that. Really sort of grassroots local organization. And I convinced my boss at the time, because I loved to sort of camp and hike and to start doing those sort of excursions with the kids that participated in their programming. And so for a while, I took mostly teenage and preteen girls backpacking. You know, it's funny, people assume that folks that live in rural communities spend a ton of time in nature and have access to green space, and that is just not the case at all in many communities. And so for many kids, it was like the first time they had gone camping or the first time they had hiked into anywhere or had sort of that outdoor expedition leadership experience. And while that was really fun, there's all sorts of fun stuff that happens there. I was always blown away by the authentic and meaningful conversations that you could start to have, that you'd see these young women start to worry less about what they were supposed to say or supposed to do as a woman in their society or as a sort of teenage girl in society, and start to like lean into their authentic versions of themselves. At least this is what I thought was witnessing, and this is sort of what triggered my interest, is that I could see that nature could play this really cool backdrop for social change. And so that's sort of when I came to CSU, that's what I was interested in. And then I started to understand and think more broadly about sort of changing environments, and whether that's biodiversity loss or that's climate change or the intersection between the two, and that that relationship is really complicated, and that nature can benefit us and then nature can also harm us, and we can do the same. And so understanding this like two-pronged bi-directional relationship between people and nature, also knowing that separation is a massive false dichotomy and a like a Western perspective for sure, that's like a key thing that we have to spend more time thinking about in really nuanced and critical ways if we're ever gonna come up with sustainability solutions that benefit both nature and people. And I know that's also probably overly hopeful that everything is always gonna benefit nature and people at the same time. It is why I'm sometimes critical of like the nature-based solutions to climate change space. It's like, yes, this is wonderful, and there are real costs and benefits and real trade-offs here, and we have to be able to acknowledge these trade-offs, but we can't acknowledge them if we can't label them and identify them. And so when I think about a well-being lens, whether that's in the nature immersion outdoor recreation space or in the climate adaptation space, if we're thinking about well-being and we're thinking about equity, we have to be able to identify those trade-offs in sort of our strategies and our action plans for sustainability.
Sounds good. So I'm curious, again, you talked about like, you know, rural people thinking rural communities will always like be outside, but that's not always the case. I'm just a little curious, like, what are some of the things you do to get people outside in these communities? Because I envision, like, for example, somebody who lives in Colorado, it wouldn't be that difficult because there's just so much to do. But what about these communities where there's like not much compared to a place like here where there's just everything going on? How do you like motivate or encourage them to get outside with nature?
Yeah, and so prior to my PhD, I was the executive director of an organization called Come Alive Outside that did most of this work in actually rural New England. And so thinking about how do we sort of come at people's relationship with nature and community and collaboratively work across sectors and organizations to increase and support the health and well-being of the community?
Yeah.
I think the first thing, and I am not the sort of academic expert in this space of what accessible and inclusive access to nature is. People often think about access as a function of geography or distance or proximity. Like, I have my access to nature, I live in the foothills, therefore I can access nature. We know that it's so much more complicated than that. We know that access to nature is also about safety and perceived safety. It's about representation and seeing yourself in that space and knowing and feeling included in that space. It's about the financial barriers to accessing some of those outdoor activities. It's about knowledge. It's also about the historical legacies of a landscape and a place. And so it's so much more complicated than, hey, I live close to nature, which is the argument that many people think, like, rural communities are in nature, and therefore they spend time in it. That doesn't mean all of these other barriers are taken care of. You know, I can speak to my personal experience growing up in a rural farming family. You know, I spent a ton of time in our sort of local area on the farm in sort of the places close to my house, but my family didn't go camping. Most of their jobs, for the most part, of my grandparents and my dad, a lot of it was spent outside. And so it was, you know, work and play. We're not going to be the same thing all the time. And that speaks to this barrier of how we define and consider nature and outdoor recreation, and thinking about redefining that based on somebody's personal relationship with nature to get the benefits of nature and to promote environmental ethic and environmental stewardship of people doesn't mean they have to go backpacking and camping, right? It means that they have to have a connection with whatever nature is to them. And so I remember going to college and, you know, finding all these friends and starting to do these activities with kids that had been doing it forever and feeling really out of place because I didn't know how to do it. I knew I loved it, but I didn't feel like I had all of this knowledge that they did until I started to understand that the time I spent on our property and in my community and working with my grandparents and working with my dad outside, it was like a fundamental piece of my relationship with nature. And so that's when I think about, like, how do I apply, like, the nature, health, and immersion stuff in communities, in rural communities, and in communities where I'm doing some more of the climate adaptation piece, is to change how we think about what people's time spent outside is, right? There's some really interesting work happening in, like, the wildlife space right now. Faculty in our department are working in this, and I've sort of been starting to collaborate with them on thinking about how we identify the benefits people get from the existence of wildlife. And there's some, like, health and well-being stuff there. If you want to start talking about the science of awe and the feeling we get when we feel smaller or part of, like, a bigger picture or something that matters more, wildlife do that to us a whole lot. Sometimes it's negative and sometimes it's positive. That's some of the stuff that I start to see applying in places like Northern Kenya. But I'm still very much working and trying to figure out how to bridge the sort of the gap between this work right now.
It's interesting. I read recently in the CSU Source newsletter that you're among the faculty that will be sharing your experience in the new graduate certificate on climate adaptation and risk management.
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit about the program as well as what students can expect to learn and take away and what's exciting about it?
Yeah, I'm really excited about this program. It has faculty with a lot of different expertise working on it. Sort of what I bring to the program is thinking about community engagement strategies and how to use participatory methods and stakeholder engagement or affected actor engagement in ways to authentically and inclusively bring people into adaptation planning and adaptation sort of actions. I think the program more broadly has a huge natural resource focus, so thinking about folks in the natural resource profession. But for a long time, we particularly, I see this all the time, this very isolated way of thinking about conservation or natural resource management over here and climate change over here. Of course, we know that's not true and that we have to address and integrate our approaches to both of those issues that are very interrelated at the same time. And so I think this, or the certificate, is a strategy for that, to give natural resource professionals, whether that's a student wanting to enter the natural resource profession or somebody who's been working in the space for a while and wanting to come back and to gain more information, to how do we manage natural resources and increase the resilience of our landscapes when we think about the impacts of climate change. And so there's everything from understanding climate adaptation models to how do we put climate adaptation plans at different scales together. And then most of my work is how do we bring people into that sort of planning and action process.
Sounds interesting. So I've heard a lot about your research. What are some of the most eye-opening experiences that you've gained from all the work that you've done?
That's a really good question. Eye-opening experiences. Well, there's, like, sort of, you know, personal and professional eye-opening experiences. So maybe I'll try to tackle that two-pronged. Professionally, I think before I got into academia, this idea that research was this really useful tool that, oh, we could collect some data and have some findings and then people would use our findings and the world would be a better place, is this really hopeful ideal that we should be moving towards. But I think my first experiences with leading research for the first time and wanting it to have applied impact and realizing how difficult it is to do so, how difficult it is to be able to speak to decision makers, local communities, and what this like grand institution of academia expects of us. That those things are sometimes in conflict with each other all of the time. And this balancing act or sort of juggling act it takes to try to meet those needs. And I thought I would finish my PhD feeling like I knew how to do that. And I definitely don't. I'm learning all of the time. I think I get better at it, but I haven't figured it out. And I think when I speak to many of my mentors and my colleagues, they would say the same thing. Like, everybody wants your work to have meaning and be useful. And also we're working in a system where that's not very easy. And so the biggest sort of surprise for me was that that was going to be a lifelong journey, and not something I figured out in the first couple of years of my PhD. And the hilarious part is hearing that now, that seems ridiculous that I thought I was going to sort that out. But I think I really did. And so it's humbling, it's frustrating, but it's also a really hopeful thing. And so when students ask me, like, well, how do you do that? And I'll say, honestly, I don't have an answer for you, but here's some questions I'm asking, here's some things that I'm thinking about, here's some micro lessons that I'm learning. Yeah. But this is not something I think I'm ever going to feel like I've totally got sorted out, that it's a sort of lifelong or at least a professional journey. I think personally living and working with cultures where you have very different ideals and identities and figuring out how to show up authentically without pushing sort of your own personal or cultural agenda. Like, I think about that in the women's empowerment space all of the time. But thinking about what does it look like to honor the inherent agency of women in a place like Samburu, not undermining it by simply saying like, oh, this community needs gender, like women's empowerment or gender equity. And also acknowledging like the very real threats to safety, health, and well-being that women face in many communities around the world, in this country, in many communities around the world. And how do we hold both to be true? And so I think about that a lot. And whether, you know, we're talking about gender equity or racial equity or rights for the LGBTQ plus community, like how you navigate all of those things in different cultures and stay personally true to yourself is something that caught me off guard more than I expected it to. And it's another thing I totally haven't figured out, but I spent a lot of time sort of talking to students and working with students to, especially when they're having their first sort of international experience or cross-cultural experience, to emotionally prepare for those sort of tensions.
Yeah.
While simultaneously acknowledge that your opportunity to have this cross-cultural experience is an absolute function of privilege. And so how do we hold all of those things to be true at the same time?
Yeah.
And so trying to prep students for the emotional sort of labor and intellectual labor that has to go into being able to do that, while keeping the backdrop of this is an incredibly privileged opportunity that you're about to have. So keep that as your framing of when you start to think about sort of these tensions around the world.
And aside from what you've mentioned, like the system and mental preparation, are there any other like challenges that you find in your research?
There's always the matchup between like time and resources. And, you know, I talked earlier about like the relationship building piece, and that no funder wants to put the time and the money that I think it takes to do good, equitable, ethical, community-based work. Like, that is a really hard thing to manage. And so how do we urgently build relationships? You know, we need to answer some of these questions. If we can at least make the science useful and get them into the hands of the right people, we need to be answering these questions and doing this science rapidly, but we also need to be doing it in ways that make sense. And so when you're working in a culture where time and relationships are valued in very different ways than your own, that's a challenge. That's something that has to be thought of critically, and it's part of the reason that my last trip wasn't about collecting data. It was about maintaining and putting time and resources into relationships. When I talk to sort of students about, okay, you want to do this experience, you need to be 100% prepared to change the way you think about relationships and time, and be able to push back on the systems here at this institution or academic institutions more broadly are going to put on you, and knowing that you sort of need to protect the way you do your work. And so that's sort of when I think about the takeaways and the surprising but important lessons from a research base. That's what comes to me.
Okay, and finally, to close out, what's some advice that you would give to grad students, those who are thinking of going to grad school or early career academics?
I think for early career academics, the things I'm finding working for me right now, and I don't know if this is going to work for everybody, is finding a community of colleagues that are thinking about and concerned about the same issues in their own research, that you don't feel like you're having this identity crisis as a researcher in a silo by yourself and figuring out, or like an echo chamber of like figuring out what's working for other people, what other issues are they experiencing, and remembering why you got into this in the first place. I think for students, and this is something that I'm working with my own students right now, is to think really strategically about this PhD, master's, whatever process you're in. What do you want out of it? So what does a successful graduate degree look like at the end of it? And I don't just mean the publication or the diploma. How would you know this went well? And so sort of thinking or reverse engineering somebody's graduate experience and your research experience, I think is a really important skill set, so that you have something to work towards. What skills do you want to gain as a researcher? What skills do you want to gain as a person? Like, what do you want to be able to say about the way you did your work? And then use that as sort of the guiding light for what you do. That is, I think, a really important tool that we should be encouraging students and faculty and researchers at all stages to be thinking about.
Some really great advice, and thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having a great conversation.